This week on Pop of Culture, we find the best places to hide a body, hypothetically.
I remember going to an ice cream shop with another mystery writer, and as we're talking, you know, in the line, the gentleman behind the counter was listening to us, and then when it was our turn, he said, I know exactly where it would go.
We're joined by crime fiction novelist Lori Rader Day.
Also on the program, an artist working in rugs and a Canadian musician living in Indiana. That's coming up in this encore edition of Pop of Culture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
From IPR, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Michelle Kinsey.
And I'm Jen Blackmer. This week on the show, we're listening back to some of our favorite interviews.
Like crime fiction novelist Lori Rader Day. She joined us last November for a conversation between the coasts.
We love talking to authors here on Pop of Culture, especially authors with Midwestern ties, as you have. So what got you into writing? Tell us a little bit about your career.
Sure. I got started writing very early. When I was a kid, I was a big reader. My mother walked us to the library, you know, every week, and we'd come back with a stack of books. So I was a big reader. And I remember when I was about, 7 years old, I realized that there was a name on the front cover of one of my favorite books that was not the name of the character. The name of the book was, you know, Ramona Quimby.
Of course.
Of course,
I grew up with Ramona, too.
I love Ramona so much. And I realized there was a name on the cover that said Beverly Cleary. And I thought, you know, here's my little seven-year-old reader thinking, who the heck is this Beverly Cleary person?
Yes.
And I realized, oh, she must be the person who is making these stories that I love so much. So I remember thinking, oh, maybe I could be that person. Maybe I could be a person who writes specifically a Ramona Quimby story. So I tried. I didn't get very far, just a couple sentences. But I remember like the power of like putting down words that did not exist before, making Ramona do things that, you know, Beverly didn't have her doing. I was making her do these things. And it was just a really powerful moment. I mean, now we would call that fan fiction, right? Like
lots of
people do it on the internet. But at the time, I think it might have been considered, you know, copyright infringement.
Oh, sure. Death. Yeah. But there's something.
So my life of crime had begun.
Excellent. I love how you talk about how empowering it is. And it really is. I mean, I talk to friends and students about what I do. And I say I make up really interesting people and then I do terrible things to them.
Oh, absolutely. You have to get them into so much trouble.
Right. Yeah. Do you have any of those early stories still?
Oh, my goodness. I don't think I have anything really early. I was my own publicist and destroyed them.
You were your own critic, too?
Yes. My grandmother used to save the things that I wrote. Like, we'd go on a family vacation, and I would take notes and write little stories about the things that happened along the way. And we would arrive at the family reunion, and then she would read my story to everybody at the reunion, even though she had been there. She liked, you know, to hear what I had seen and what I had noticed. So she was one of my early, you know, promoters, I guess. So I wrote, you know, most of my life, but not very seriously. I dabbled. Mm-hmm. I dabbled for a very long time. And it took quite a few years to get serious about it. So I wrote all through high school. I was in the creative writing club. Mm-hmm. I only mentioned that because it was very pivotal in that one year when I was a sophomore, I think, I won the creative writing contest that year, beating the senior boy who had been winning every year. Yes.
Excellent. Good for you.
yeah, good for me. He was not happy. Oh. But he was a very good friend of mine. And later on, he was very pivotal in that he was serious about writing all along. And when his first book was being published in 2006, I realized he had centered his life around writing in a way that I had not. Oh. He was going places. He had, you know, figured out how to you know, tell these stories about people from where we're from. We were from the very same small town, mm-hmm. and actually both went to Ball State. So Christopher Koch is another writer from Ball State University. And because he got published, he was getting published, I got serious. Mm-hmm. And so envy is a very good fuel to sure. get back to where you wanted to be.
Yeah, and it helps us with goal setting as well, right? That when you see somebody who is kind of living a life that you would like to have, and it's never the same, of course, but it gives you an idea of things that you want to strive for and do.
Absolutely. And he, you know, I kind of thought writing was a thing that other people got to do until he did it. And mm-hmm. then I thought, well, but he's from the same place I am. You know, we'd been friends for, you know, at that point, 20 years probably. If he could work toward it and achieve it, then maybe so could I. Mm-hmm. So I got serious about it, went back to school again. <I did. laughs> I'm highly overeducated. Thank you, Ball State. And with 2 degrees from them in journalism. And then I went back and did a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing and just, you know, got serious about it, wrote much more often than I had been doing mm-hmm. most of my life, and started getting published. Short stories started getting accepted. And then one of my short stories got long. And mm-hmm. the long story, it turns out, was a crime story. So that's how I became a crime writer, just sort of backed into it.
Oh, wow. So the story that you had written, you didn't necessarily set out to write a mystery or a crime story, but that's just how it evolved?
Yeah, I was just writing a short story. I had gone to the library. Libraries also figure very heavily in my writing life.
As they do, all of us.
Right.
So just important. Being surrounded by books is amazing.
It's the best system in the world, and we cannot lose it. I'll just say that.
Yes.
So I went to the library. I think I had a story due in my workshop, you know, for my Master of Fine Arts class. I needed to turn in some pages, so I was going to start a new story. So I went to the library sort of looking for inspiration, and I found a book about handwriting analysis. And I don't know anything about handwriting analysis at the time, so I thought, well, I'll just pick it up and see. And I ended up writing about a character who is a handwriting analyst, someone who looks at handwriting and, you know, knows things about primarily, is it the same person who signed one document as signed the other document, but also some personality traits from what they see on the page. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a short story about that, dusted my hands off and said, look, I've got a short story. Isn't that great? But at my workshop, all the other students wanted more about the character and more about how she became a handwriting analyst and how this worked and how this relationship was going to go and more and more and more and more and more, right? Mm-hmm. So my teacher said, yeah, Lori, that's because it's a novel. You just have to keep writing, which was a surprise to me.
Sure. It's kind of a double-edged sword, right? It's so great that everybody wants to know more about these characters that you've created. But at the same time, you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I was done with them. That is not good news. But right around that time, I had gone to Midwest Writers Conference, which is a conference that's in Muncie, Indiana. Yeah. And I had gone as just an attendee, sort of like just picking up, you know, lots of knowledge about writing. And I got accepted into a program they were doing at the time. They don't do it, unfortunately, anymore. But it was a weekend retreat. And when I arrived, I was one of 9 people who had been accepted into 3 groups. The 3 groups were divided by fiction, nonfiction, and mystery. And I had been put in the mystery group.
Oh, wow.
But as far as I knew, though, I was not writing a mystery. This was all news to me. So when I got into the group, the teacher, he said, yeah, it's there's a crime in your uh-huh. first 15 pages. So yeah, that's why they think it's a mystery. So, you know, but it's up to you. It doesn't have to be. But if you think you might like to write a crime story, let's think about what that means versus what you thought you were doing. Mm-hmm. And actually, it was very helpful because now if it's a crime story, then I know that the central story is this crime that I had inserted. And I knew how to continue, which, mm-hmm. you know, I hadn't known before. So finding out what kind of writer I was actually really helpful. It saved me probably a couple of years of trying to figure out who I was.
It's a true testament to the role that our teachers and mentors and colleagues play in our lives, right? We think of writing as a very solitary endeavor, but that's really only part of it. A lot of it is connecting with others who will read your work and give you good feedback and kind of become your community.
Absolutely. The Mystery Writing community has been really valuable to me. I mean, getting started with Midwest Writers was fantastic. And from there, I discovered there was this entire world of mystery writing that you just had to, you know, find the right door. Mm-hmm. So I joined Sisters in Crime, a national organization for anyone, really. You don't have to be a sister. you can be a sibling. And Mystery Writers of America, these are just two of the associations that help writers find their way. Mm-hmm. It's a great group to join when you're still trying to find your way. So obviously I'm still a member as a professional now, but
crowd. When you gather with these folks at these conferences, do you talk about mysteries and structure, or is it more career oriented, or is it both?
It's both. Yeah. So we will get together and talk about, you know, where we are professionally and also just in, we're just friends at this point. We just talk as friends, you know, what are you up to with your life? How is your family? Mm-hmm. You know, that housing addition you're putting on, you know, whatever it is, we just talk like friends. But then also once in a while, we scare the waiters away by talking about where we might hide a body in this particular venue. I remember going to an ice cream shop with another mystery writer. And as we're talking, you know, in the line, the gentleman behind the counter was listening to us. And then when it was our turn, he said, I know exactly where it would go. And he lifted up the ice cream bin and he showed us the space under the ice cream bin. I'm like, thank you so much, sir.
Wow.
One of us is going to use that someday.
I was going to say, please tell me that's filed away somewhere in your head.
It's filed away. We always just file it away for later.
Wow. That's incredible. So tell us about your writing process, Lori. Like what does a typical day look like for you?
I wish I had better news for you. I'm very undisciplined when it comes to writing. You're probably much more disciplined than I am, Jen.
I don't know.
I like to call my process haphazard. Uh-huh. But I do write more days than not. And when I'm on a deadline, when I have something, you know, really going, or I'm, you know, drafting toward a certain deadline, I am disciplined and can be disciplined. Mm-hmm. I wrote my first two books while I was working full time. So the only hour of the day that I could, you know, usually claim as my own was my lunch hour. And it was difficult. I had to mm-hmm. turn down, you know, really nice lunch invitations with real people to go hang out with fake people. But that's how I got my first two books written. And, you know, that takes a certain amount of discipline. And now that I'm a full-time writer, I have a lot more time, mm-hmm. But I am less disciplined because of it, unfortunately.
Well, and it's funny because I tell my students that, you know, you have to be disciplined, you have to have a process, you have to write every day. And then sometimes when life gets in the way, I mean, it's you do what you have to do in order to do what you want to do. And sometimes, go ahead.
I would actually argue with you on the everyday thing. I actually believe that you don't have to write every day. It's just helpful if you do. Because if you are spending a little time on your story every day, even just thinking about it when you're driving somewhere, maybe, or taking notes during a meeting or whatever, then you are still connecting to that story. You're keeping the story alive. You're keeping the character alive. That's why it's the everyday thing is important. Mm-hmm. But I truly don't write every day.
Yeah.
I just try to write more days than not.
Mm-hmm. I like the idea you're talking about is spending time with your characters, right? And sometimes writing isn't writing. You know, sometimes it's staring at a wall, or it's doing it, you know, as you say, while you're driving or while you're shopping for groceries or something like that.
Driving is one of the, I get a lot of great ideas while I'm driving. When I drive back to Indiana, there's a long stretch of just cornfield, which of course I'm used to. Mm-hmm. But I get a lot of great ideas from driving through Indiana.
And you teach, is that correct?
Yeah, I teach for Northwestern University. Mm-hmm. I used to be an administrator for them. That was the job I mentioned that I used to write mm-hmm. during my lunch hours. And then I left that job and did my MFA. And then I got asked to teach eventually after my book started being published. So I teach for the MFA program in the School of Professional Studies. So we have a lot of, people who are trying to make it work while they have day jobs. And that's just a perspective that I think is really important. You know, not everybody mm-hmm. can quit their full-time job to be a writer. So we want those stories too. You know,
absolutely. We want stories from, yeah. And that's actually what led to this question, because tell us a little bit about your students, about your cohort, like not specifically, but who is attracted to the program and what are some of their backgrounds?
Yeah, it's interesting. I went to what you would probably call a residential type program, where it's more of like a traditional university program mm-hmm. at Roosevelt University, downtown Chicago. Mm-hmm. But I like working with and hearing from writers who have lived. You know, it's great if a student who's just out of their undergraduate program decides to go get a master's degree. But when it's a creative writing master's degree, I think it's really helpful if you've had a job and you've mm-hmm. worked, you know, you've been in the world a little bit. You've got sure. some stories to tell instead of just trying to dig it out of your own feelings, you know. But the students in this program are just phenomenal students. They're very bright and they're very, one of the first things I noticed is they do all the reading.
Yeah.
I've taught other places. That is not always
the case. That is not the case.
They are very eager to learn and they're in my workshop. My workshop is a genre fiction workshop. So mm-hmm. They're willing to try new things. Maybe it's not something that they thought that they were interested in, but I just welcome any story they want to tell. So they can have ghosts, they can have monsters, they can have, you know, and worlds that they have imagined to exist in other planets, you know, whatever it is that they want to write, they can bring to my class.
Yeah, that's excellent. And the idea of people from all walks of life, all ages, all levels of experience can come together in a cohort in your class is really interesting to me. And I like to talk to people a lot about how it's never too late, right? It's never too late to discover that you have stories you want to tell. And really learning how to write is just about crafting and recognizing the tools that you have.
Absolutely. And I think many people who are even interested a little bit in writing, they know they have stories to tell. That's not a surprise to them. But hearing that there's a reason to tell them, to go ahead and try to write them down, that's what's news to them. They may not realize that there is value in just the process of writing, whether anything gets published or not. There's a lot you can gain from learning how to write and then improving your craft over time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, speaking of craft, how do you craft a mystery?
It is, you're probably asking the wrong person, because I am what is called a pantser, someone who writes by the seat of their pants. I mentioned my haphazard process, and this is part of it. I don't know exactly where I'm going when I get started.
That's exciting, though. I love that.
I think it's exciting, and I have to keep my excitement up or I won't do the work, right? If I'm interested, if I want to know where this story goes, then, I'll get to the page and I'll work it out day by day. But there are people who will sit down and plan every aspect of a story and then start writing. And to me, that would kill, I think, what I love best about writing, which is the discovery. Mm-hmm. As I'm writing, when something sort of starts to lift off the page and it seems like the writing is doing itself,
mm-hmm.
that's this weird moment of almost magic.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't want to do anything that would kill that energy. And that's what I think plotting would do to my process. I wish it were easier. I wish that I had tips and tricks that would just make it, this is how you do it, slot A into B, right? But it's really not that easy. It's just about sitting down and, you know, finding a quiet space, a quiet moment, and then starting to write things down mm-hmm. and learning as you go and making things better as you go. Oh, I rely on revision quite a bit because of the way I write, probably. Mm-hmm. I have to leave a lot of room for improvement at the end of the process. So I know, you know, if I discover as I go, I can fix it. You know, I can make everything that I've just discovered true from the beginning when I get back to revision.
Yeah. Two things you mentioned, I think, are really resonating with me right now. The idea that as you sit down to write, you're also learning, right? This idea that an artist, and in this specific case, a writer, is also learning about all kinds of things that interest them, right? That it's a vehicle to learn about the world and be curious about things.
Absolutely. I keep little links or a document where I have ideas, anything that catches my attention, I'll just kind of tuck it away and think, maybe there's something here, you know, maybe not, but maybe there's a short story here, or maybe there's a setting I can use, or maybe this job this person has is something I can use later. So I've been inspired by things like dark sky parks when I heard that these things existed, where they control artificial light to protect the night sky so that we can see it the way that nature intended. I live in Chicago. I can see about 2 stars.
That's right.
Of a night, right? So that was an interesting location for me. So that was the start of one of my books, Under a Dark Sky. I've had, ideas for characters. We'll start a book, something that I want to spend time with. My next book is based in the country music scene in Chicago. Yes, there's a country music scene in Chicago.
There is.
Just because country music was giving me some joy during, 2020. If you remember 2020.
Oh, I don't know if I remember much of 2020. But yes, finding joy was crucial during that time.
Yeah. And then the next, as soon as I get done with my edits for that book, I will go back to my work in progress, which is totally so new. I don't even want to talk that much about it, but it has private investigator type vibes. And when I was thinking about where do I want to write about, what kind of community do I want to write about? I thought about when I used to live in downtown Muncie, Indiana, and how I lived above a business and I was friends with my neighbors next door who lived above another business. And I was friends with the people who owned the businesses down below. And so I've started writing about Muncie.
Yeah, I love that. And I know our audiences will love that as well, to be featured in a mystery novel, an upcoming mystery novel that you can't tell us a whole lot about yet.
I can tell you it'd probably be out in 2027. So got a little ways before that.
All right. We'll mark our calendars. What else do you have coming up, Lori?
Well, my next book is called Wreck Your Heart, and that is going to be out in winter of 2026. So that's probably January to March 2026. So I'm working on edits for that now. My last book was out in October 2023. That was The Death of Us. That idea came from, to go back to your idea, ideas come from wherever. That idea came from looking out the window when I was, 30,000 feet in the air above middle America, looking down and seeing a little tiny quarry. Yeah. And I thought, I bet there are a lot of bodies in places and bodies of water like that. And it turns out, Jen, I'm right. So, So, you can get ideas from anywhere at all.
Yes, you can. Well, Lori, I can't thank you enough for spending time with us today. I have thoroughly enjoyed our conversation about writing and crafting and your process or a haphazard process, which I get a ton of inspiration from. Sometimes I plan a little too much myself. So I love hearing that joy of just kind of diving in, and thoroughly excited to see what's next for you.
Thank you so much for having me, Jen.
That was crime fiction novelist Lori Rader Day. We spoke to her back in November.
Indiana Artisan Marketplace is this weekend in Indianapolis.
So we thought we'd listen back to one of the artisans you can find there. Our co-host Kara Duquette has this one.
Tracy Burns is an Indiana artisan and has been rug hooking for 25 years. And she and her husband have brought so many beautiful pieces into the studio today. I mean, I had looked you up online to see some of your work, but I had not seen it till today. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I really appreciate you being here with us. Can you tell us a little bit about rug hooking? Because I have some things in my mind about it that I don't believe I know what it is.
Okay. A lot of people don't. They think it's a latch hook or a punch needle. But it's much, much older than that. Punch needle and locker hooking and latch hook are all from the late 1920s to 1930s. But rug hooking can trace back all the way to the Vikings.
Ooh. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's the original.
Yes. And it was one of the very first, you know, recycling projects, basically.
Okay. So how do you do it?
Okay. Well, when the Vikings would have done it, they would have taken their their worn out sails and worn out clothing, and they would have fashioned a hook out of a knife, a bone, whatever, that would come through the open weave of the sail. And then they would put their old clothing in there, and it would make mats. They would do things for chairs, make them softer. They make them for keeping out drafts on walls because, you know, they didn't have insulation back then. So this was a way to do that. Or they made them for their beds or things to keep them warm. And then as the Vikings traveled through Europe and then where all the sea areas were, and they came down through Nova Scotia, then into the United States.
Okay.
So like Newfoundland and all those places, and then down through the United States from Nova Scotia on. So,
well, now, how did you discover rug hooking?
At the Indiana State Fair, at the Pioneer Building, we went in 1999. My sister fell in love with it the first time she saw it. And I was just, I just walked by, didn't, you know, pay much attention. She goes, "We need to take these classes." I said, "No, we don't." she talked me into it. So that was in August of 99. And then by October, she had talked me into taking classes with a lady that was like 30 minutes from our home. The first two, I wasn't really crazy about. But I talked myself into my third class. And I'm glad I did, because that's where I met the lady that designed her own rugs and then dyed her own wool. So I could see that it could be something more than just what I was seeing there, that I could be more creative and do it myself.
Okay, so in my mind, what you're talking about when you speak about Vikings, their take on it, so we weren't talking a lot of color at that point.
Not really, no.
Okay,
yeah.
Because this work is so vibrant that mm-hmm. you do.
Yeah.
So you met this person who opened up your creativity. So then what happened, like, for you?
Okay, so from there, I started taking interest in, okay, how can I make this a little more my style? How do I get away from always the primitive look? And then I started seeking out different teachers that had unique styles that they wanted to do. So they were doing more bright flowers, or if you wanted to shade. I have one here that I have, the flowers have six values in each petal. So that gives you a more realistic look of color. And so, well, like the cougar one here, this is my very first piece that I made as an animal. So I had a very good teacher that specialized in animals and how to dye for them and things like that. So she was from Virginia. So I've actually have taken lessons from 12 different instructors from across the country and one from Nova Scotia.
Okay.
And so they've all done different techniques that I've incorporated in mine.
So so we'll stick with the cougar for now. What, you're not using a Viking sail. So what is the basis or the base piece for your...
Okay. Well, we use... some people still use burlap, but that's the least that we want to use because that one is the least expensive, but we found out that it's also the one that will not last as long.
Oh.
Because burlap only lasts 50 years before it dry rots. And so then that's when things start falling apart. So if you go to an antique store and you see a hand-tooked rug, if it's falling apart, it's because it's on burlap. And then what I prefer and what's the best is linen. And all of this is made in Scotland just for rug hooking. Oh. I do have some samples here. So What we have are these weaves that are made in Scotland just for rug hooking.
Okay.
Now, we order them here in the U.S. Anybody that does rug hooking or has a shop will carry these by the bolt so that you can order it. And the reason why we do it that way is because this is what you get from Walmart, Joann Fabrics, Hancock Fabrics, Hobby Lobby, quilt shops. This is all you get. And you can see that those are not the quality that you want. If you put 24 hours into a square foot of work, you don't want it to fall apart.
You can see the different tension in it. It's so if you just imagine a piece of burlap, very similar in view, but much tighter. And
yes.
It stays tight.
Yes.
Throughout the process of the hooking.
Mm-hmm.
So how does the hooking transpire? So you take the base and then mm-hmm. you've brought some tools here. Mm-hmm. And what do you do with the tools to get the actual look that you want?
Okay. So I have a cutter. And so you can cut your wool with a pair of scissors.
Okay.
I did that one time.
One time only.
Yes. It was a very small piece. It was probably, I think 12 inches in round. And cutting with scissors is hard when you're cutting wool and trying to keep it straight. And then it was never the right size. It was more primitive. And if you want the primitive look, scissors are great. But then all that cutting hurts your hands after a while.
And the width wasn't precise.
Right. And okay. It wasn't precise. Yeah. And so...
you're going to cut a piece for us.
So by taking it through here, I can get three pieces or four pieces the same width.
Excellent.
And those are 3/16.
Okay. That gives me a much better idea how this happens. That's like a wheel. It looks like it's mm-hmm. got, you said the blades aren't very sharp, but you can just run the fabric through.
Mm-hmm. So,
okay.
So, and then I take the hook and I go under my fabric. So I just hold it between my fingers, pull under, and then bring to the top. And then it's just a matter of loops.
Okay.
And there's no knots.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
So Tracy is pulling the fabric piece through the warp and the wet mm-hmm. of the under
mm-hmm.
half.
Of the linen. Mm-hmm.
Of the linen to get the image, to create the image. I'm wondering where we can find your work. And mm-hmm. is your work form and function?
Yes, you can use it actually as a rug.
Excellent.
You can turn them into pillows, chair pads, and then these are basically made for wall hangings. And then I do not put a frame around them. I put them on a stretcher frame because frames can be expensive, and if somebody doesn't like the frame I pick, they may not buy it. So this way they can pick the artwork and then they can put their own style of frame around it. I will be... doing the Fiber Art Festival in Portland, Indiana, and that's coming up in March 7th and 8th, and I'll have my work on display there. I'll be teaching a class, and also the Indiana Artisan Marketplace coming up the last weekend of March, and I will be a vendor there. I'll be demonstrating, and my work will be for sale there, because everything in the marketplaces for sale.
Excellent. And can you share your website with us?
It's tcburnsrugs.wix.com/house on the hill.
Great. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us today and showing us your beautiful work.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
That was Tracy Burns speaking with our co-host, Kara Duquette.
Pop of Culture. I'm Jen Blackmer.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. It's the part of the show where we ask an artist, what are you working on?
And today we're listening back to some of our favorite interviews, like when our co-host Kara Duquette spoke with Dana Powell.
She is a Canadian singer, songwriter, and pianist now living in Indiana. Dana's first full-length country pop album, Your Love Is Enough, was released a few months ago in August 2024. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to ask, what are you working on now?
Ooh, so right now, I actually just got the first kind of demo draft of my new single that's coming out in January from the producer this morning. So Ooh. The first time I heard it, and I am like, I am freaking out. It sounds so good.
Nice. Yeah. Have you worked with this producer before?
Okay, or? Funny story. Okay. So I used to be a music director on cruise ships. I used to work on cruise ships, played in bands, and Carl, who owns Brickshed Studios in Fort Wayne, was actually the drummer in our band. This was like 10 years ago. I've not heard from him. I've not talked to him since then. I moved to Indiana, found out he lived here. We reconnected, and now he's producing my next single, and it is amazing.
It's a small world after all.
Exactly.
That's a crazy exactly. story. Mm-hmm. So what was the inspiration behind this single?
So the song is called Where Would We Be? And the inspiration behind it is when you get that feeling where you are maybe overwhelmed or just some part of you just wants to give up and quit. And the song is based around that. So where would we be if you gave up whenever things got hard, if you quit, if you didn't say what you want to say at the time. So that's what the song is inspired by.
Oh, I'm looking very forward to hearing it. I could use a little bit of that motivation right now in my own life.
Oh.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Things will be all right.
They will be. And a lot of the times, you know, that where you get to that point, you just push past a little bit more and then you know, it just, then you look back in a few months and go, oh my gosh, I can't believe I was going to give up on that.
Did you want to talk to us a little bit about your album that dropped this summer, Your Love Is Enough?
Sure. So I was working on that album a long time, writing those songs. So I had all the musicians and I got it all together and I got the guitar and the drums and everything. And then by the time I had recorded all the parts, I'm like, okay, now I have no money to produce this and mix this album. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to have to do it all myself. So I did. Nice. And it's got a very much, you know, live performance sound. It's very acoustic sound. So for that album. So what I'm working on in the future is to get more of a commercial sound, but that album there is very much stripped down.
Well, I hope that people give it a listen. Talked a little bit about some of your motivation for your single that's coming out. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about where do you think you're going as you move forward in your career with Ooh, music.
Well, I mean, there's where I hope I'm going. Great. I can talk about that.
Let's talk about that.
So I really am really trying to break out onto the commercial radio scene, and I know that is extremely, it's very, very hard, but that's where I'm focused right now is kind of the commercial adult contemporary / country markets and live performance.
Well, I as you talk about breaking into commercial music, what is your genre? Right. I mean, I know your album, Your Love Is Enough, is country pop. But what kind of, are you going to stay in that genre? Are you looking at other genres?
Yeah, I'm going to stay in that genre. It's kind of like crossover because you can, I mean, if you listen to country radio right now, there's a lot of pop, right? Like pop sounding elements. it's still country, but it's very poppy. So it's kind of like in that genre, maybe Lauren Elena. I love Tennille Arts. I love Carly Pierce. And I also love Adele. So it's like, it's kind of, those are my influence, big influences. So it's in that area.
Okay. Yeah, I do think that the genres are starting to blur. I don't know.
Right.
Like you said, a lot of crossover.
Yeah, and I think happening. That comes a lot too from like the digital side of things, right? Mm-hmm. Adding all these digital elements into your music can really, maybe not broaden, but just reach maybe a broader audience.
Yeah, and you might hear a song that you just pick up and put on a playlist and mm-hmm. suddenly you're listening to all sorts of genres.
Right. So yeah, and I came from, so my background is actually, I went to college for jazz piano. Oh. So this is I've gone through, I put actually, you know, recorded jazz before, and then I decided I don't want to record jazz and I want to do pop and country music. But all of those influences, you know, combined produce that sound.
Yeah.
Drawn from a lot of different influences.
I really like it when people have an eclectic mix of their experiences that shows through in their
yeah.
work.
Yeah. Well, I think that's like the only way to write, right? Is from your own, to really write authentically. It's like from your own personal experiences.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. Where can people find you currently online?
Oh, everything is listed on my website, danapowellmusic.com. So, you know, wherever you, Spotify, Apple Music, Instagram, Facebook, wherever you want to go, it's all there.
And I have a question for you. So do you miss Canada at all? Or have you adjusted to life in Indiana?
Oh, I definitely miss Canada. Like, I definitely miss parts. There's things I miss for sure. There's also things here that are just that I love too. So it's, you know, it's trade-offs. It's like, obviously my family's in Canada, so that's a big one for me, right? But I like that it's warmer here. The summers are longer. It's easy to get to different cities here. The music scene is better. Sorry, okay. I don't know if I should say that, but
that's yeah. wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, and we'll look forward to hearing more from you.
Thank you so much. But I won't lose hope, won't lose sight of all the beauty in this life. There are times when it's so hard to see, but then you show me. You show me. You show me.
It's that time again, Michelle, my favorite time, where we talk about all the great stuff happening here in East Central Indiana.
Love it. Why don't I start us off, Jen?
Go for it.
Great. A community portrait, spring edition, is on display now through May at Minnetrista Museum and Gardens. Portrait photographer Tom Sterkowitz has turned his lens on our community, capturing our neighbors in moments of play, connection, and introspection. This exhibition features a selection of the unique images produced through this project. Minnetrista.net. has more details.
It's an awesome project. I love that project.
Yes, did you
so
have your
much.
Portrait taken?
I not this time, but I will next time.
Yes, I did it the first time around.
I know, and, yeah. I know. Okay, next up, Ball State's Department of Women, Gender, and African American Studies and David Owsley Museum of Art at Ball State will present Illuminating 20th Century Women's Voices Through Music, Friday, March 28th at the museum. This lecture recital brings together three Ball State faculty members for a performance that celebrates 20th century women composers and their works. Galit Gernsenson, piano from the Honors College, Kendra Lowry, piano from Teachers College, and Cynthia L. Smith from the College of Fine Arts will perform works by Mabel Bailey, Margaret Bonds, Henrietta Bosemans, Valerie Capers, Geraldine Saunders Herbison, and Florence Price. The music begins at 1 p.m.
What an interesting concert.
I know,
Really cool. The Indianapolis Ballet and the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra will present Swan Lake Friday and Saturday, March 28th and 29th at Clues Hall in Indy. Swan Lake is the quintessential classic ballet steeped in themes of temptation, jealousy, deception, and drama. Set against Tchaikovsky's iconic score, butlerartscenter.org has more info.
Can't get better than Swan Lake.
Great.
I'm telling you. All right. On Saturday, March 29th, Tommy James and the Shondells will perform at the Paramount Theater in Anderson. Remember these tunes, Michelle? We're Alone Now.
Uh-huh.
Moni Moni.
Yep.
Crimson and Clover.
Yep.
Crystal Blue Persuasion.
Love it.
Yep. He'll be singing those and more. AndersonParamount.org has the details.
That was actually the very first album I convinced my mom to buy off the television.
Way.
You know, those KTEL yes. collections. It was Tommy James and the Shondells' greatest hits. I think I was like four.
I've got
like,
Crystal Blue. Crystal Blue Persuasion in my head right now.
The Indiana Artisan Marketplace is Saturday and Sunday, March 29th and 30th at the Indiana State Fairgrounds in Indianapolis. Indiana artisans include artists, which is painters, woodworkers, jewelry designers, weavers, and artisans, beekeepers, makers of specialty sauces, chocolatiers, and so much more. Details at IndianaArtisan.org.
Great. Now I'm hungry.
I know.
Okay. April's first Thursday is April 3rd. Enjoy exhibits, browse maker booths, and listen to live music beginning at 5 p.m. at various downtown Muncie locations. DowntownMuncie.org has the complete schedule. If you have an event that Pop of Culture listeners should know about, tell us at IndianaPublicRadio.org/contact, then click Pop of Culture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at IndianaPublicRadio.org.
And that's our show. Our fact checker and shadow producer is Stephanie Weekman. And our regular producer is Luke Jones, who is solving mysteries in the Arizona desert.
Good luck, Luke.
Yes. Our show was hosted by me, Michelle Kinsey.
And me, Jen Blackmer. Pop of Culture is a production of IPR on the campus of Ball State University.
Okay, how do you want to divide it, lady?
Lady!
Oh.